is where we'll start. And we're going to get right into our lesson. If there are a few handouts left up there, if you need a handout, they're on the outside of the door there, although I may not have made enough. We have a good group tonight, which is a blessing. And so we are talking here about marriage. Let me back up a little bit to this particular diagram, just because I think it's helpful. It is in your notes as well. And this is, we talked last week a lot about having God in the center of your marriage, that we want God to be something. We don't want, it's so easy for us to focus on the horizontal issues and problems and struggles and difficulties of life and planning and scheduling and all those kinds of things, that if we're not careful, we can leave the Lord out of our marriage, where we're not praying together, we're not discussing what God would want, what would please the Lord in the plans that we're making, what would be best to serve Him out of love for Him, and those kinds of things. And so we talked a great deal about that, and so this diagram pictures it well, that God desires for a husband and wife to be in union with each other, and that union is really ought to be held together by God as we trust Him. And often, I mean, if you take a secular marriage, and I'll just say it this way, if you take a secular marriage and you consider our culture and the fact that you do not have God holding the marriage together in a secular culture, what are the chances of it staying together anymore? I mean, we used to be in a culture where there was sort of this pressure to stay together, this pressure to not divorce. And sometimes it's unavoidable, but there used to at least be this pressure. And now the culture is sort of saying exactly the opposite. They're sort of saying, well, if you're not happy, just get out. And of course, we know that it is God's desire, if at all possible, for the marriage to be able to stay intact. And so, how does that happen? Well, as we trust God, as we depend upon Him, we're not going to just depend on ourselves. We're not going to depend on the spouse. As we trust in God and rely on Him, then it can keep our union together. And so, I think this is a good illustration just to keep in our minds when you're tempted either to rely on yourself or to act or react or live in a way that's not trusting in the Lord. I think it's important to understand that. And so we're going to move then today, so let me get through these. We're going to move today into laying a biblical foundation for your marriage. And obviously the foundation for everything is in the book of Genesis. And so we're going to be looking at verses, actually we're going to look at Genesis 1 first, verses 26 through 28. And then we're also going to be looking at Genesis 2 in a few moments as well. I will tell you that there are a lot of really good foundational things tonight. You think, well, Genesis 1, I know Genesis 1, I grew up in church. And you're going to find some things tonight, I think, that perhaps you haven't thought of before when it comes to Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. And sort of the outflowing applications of this. So if you'd take your Bibles and turn there, we're going to read verses 26 and 27 and 28 as well. It says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness.'" So he's talking about the creation of man here, or the word man would be mankind here, or humankind. "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Notice what it says, created male and female, he created them. So they have different roles. They're created differently. Then God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it." So he says to them together, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it. Together, he says, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over everything that moves on the earth. and my pages are sticking together. They're really sticking. Okay. And so that's verses 26 through 28 of this passage. Then what you're going to have as you move into Genesis 2 is you're going to have a further detailing of how this is supposed to take place. But let me begin by just pointing out a few things about marriage and creation and what we see in this passage. First of all, man and woman are created in equal in dignity and value, but different roles. You see that in the passage. They're both created in what? In God's image. Okay? They're both equally created in God's image that way. So they are equal in value, and they're equal in dignity, but we clearly see also that he created them distinct, right? He created them male and female, so they have distinct roles. One is not lesser than the other. One is not less valuable than the other. They are distinct, and they are equal in value. The complementary nature of man, what we see in the passage, just in the very outset of chapter 1, is that men and women are complementary. A man and a woman together in marriage, they are, is complementary. I'm a little too hot, I think. Got it. So, this, by the way, is a real debate right now in Christianity. The other side of this is something called egalitarian, rather than complementarian. And the egalitarian says that men and women are equal, both complementarian and egalitarian say that, but that their roles are not distinct. And you have churches now that allow women in leadership and those kinds of things as a result of that. And so we need to understand they're complementary to each other. And we see that in the passage. And then we see that the imperative nature of, we're going to see in this passage in chapter 2, of leaving a family of origin and cleaving as one flesh. It's very clearly in the passage, and we're going to see why that's so important. So a few things, three important concepts that we see, and they're in your notes as well, that we see from 26 through 28. Number one, that we are image bearers. And we've already mentioned this already, but we'll just mention this again. To be an image bearer means we are reflecting the image or likeness of another. In this case, man and woman reflect the character of God. Men and women are equal in dignity and value. So we are image bearers. So what we're doing now is we're just establishing the clear foundation, and then we're going to build on this foundation when we get into chapter 2. Also, we are supposed to have dominion. That is something in our very embedded in our very purpose for why God created us. He created us to have dominion. One part of being an image bearer involves serving God's representatives in the Garden of Eden. We see this in the text twice, in 26 and 27. As mankind is labeled as image bearers, and then shortly after is called to rule or to have dominion, 27 and 28. The principle here is one of stewardship. So important. It's one of stewardship. God is the owner and creator of creation, and man and woman are appointed as his divine caretakers. And that is the case as we go throughout life. God's intention prior to the fall was not that man and woman would own everything, but that they would be stewards of what God owns. And when we are saved, we're bought back, we're bought with a price, we are now owned by God. And what God gives us, we are to be stewards of what he gives us. Yes, Jeff?
Would that give an organization like Greenpeace a biblical foundation for their activities?
Can you elaborate why that might be?
Greenpeace is like a very liberal organization designed to protect the environment from all of mankind's incursions, protecting all the animals and the resources, etc.
Yeah, I would say it doesn't because it would go, in my opinion, is that it would go too far. It would take ownership rather than stewardship. So that's actually a perfect example of going too far. Now, should we be good stewards of what God's given us? Should we be good stewards of creation? Yeah, we definitely should. But do we own it? We don't own it. And the way that their philosophy, I suspect, I don't know that particular organization, but I suspect their philosophy is that not only do we own it, but we are responsible solely to preserve it as though, I mean, a lot of times they get into idolatry where they're just seeing creation as God. They take the, it takes the place of God. Romans 1. What's that?
Gaia worship.
Huh?
Gaia worship.
You ever
heard
that? Gaia worship?
Yeah, Gaia means
Mother Earth. Mother Earth, yeah. So a lot of that happens behind there. So in fact, that is a lot of things in life. If we don't learn to take, if we understand stewardship instead of ownership, it really affects us, our families. I don't own my kids. I'm stewards of God, of what God's given me. Understanding stewardship versus ownership, it, my, you know, spouses, families, everything. Understanding this is so important. Yeah.
I think they would definitely view it as stewardship, but I think to your point, it goes into ownership because they view it as their responsibility.
Yeah.
To kind of maintain it, which is greater than just stewardship.
Yeah, I mean, it is our responsibility to maintain it. I almost think that they're, I mean, I don't know, but because I don't know the organization, but I suspect a lot of these organizations, they think their responsibility is to preserve it, like it's going bad, and we've got to be the gods that we're not and do something about this. Yeah.
I think they also do not see humankind as God's special
creation. Yeah.
And given stewardship.
Definitely. Yeah. They usually see man. Yeah. Yeah. They usually see man as mammals that are animals and just part of the top of the animal kingdom. And frankly, sometimes now they were the vice, like humanity is the problem with the whole world, and we all ought to just die and let the animals own it all or something. But anyway, yeah. Was there another question or something around here? Yeah. So dominion is a really important concept. We are stewardships. We are stewarding God's kingdom. Is essentially what we're doing. And in the very beginning, that's what God created us to do. Procreation is another thing that he clearly says that we're supposed to do. One way in which a man and woman can rule and subdue the earth is to have children. Be fruitful and increase in number. We rule the earth by filling the entire planet with worshipers, image bearers who reflect back to God his own glory. So he says, be fruitful and multiply. He says that throughout Genesis, constantly saying that. Be fruitful and multiply. And I always tell, in premarital counseling, I always tell people getting married, there's good reasons why you might want to hold off on having kids for a little while, but marriage and kids go hand in hand. God said that. And he keeps saying it over and over and over again in the New Testament. And so it's important to understand that. If you can have kids, and if you can't, then the Lord has reasons for that, and he wants you to understand that there's other ways of stewardship as well. Then look at Genesis chapter 2, verse 15. Go ahead and turn over there. Genesis 2, 15. He says, then the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. So he took the man and did that. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat, for in the day you eat it, you shall surely die. Before the woman is on the scene, God puts man in the garden to work it and to take care of it. This is more than doing minimal work and going home. As God's representative, Adam was called to make the garden flourish and grow, to take care of it. So that was a mandate to Adam before even the woman got on the scene. Now understand, we know from chapter 1 that Adam and Eve are both supposed to have dominion, and they're both supposed to be subduing it, all those kinds of things. But now we have a breakdown in Genesis chapter 2 of some of the roles, and we see man is given that role in the beginning. But then, chapter 2, verse 18, it's not good that man should be alone. Look at what it says here in verse 18. Lord said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him. And so he says, or suitable would be another way of saying it. So he says, it's not good that man should be alone. And there's a lot of implications about what that means. First of all, it means companionship. So God saw that there was companionship that was needed, and God wanted, he said, it's not good that man should not have a companion. He needs a companion, and so he made woman for companionship. And he also made them to complement, made a woman to complement the man, to be a helper, a helper suitable for him. And that's pretty well, I think most of us understand that that's the case. So let's talk about what it is for a... So we see that the role of the man, it actually says, for example, it gives Adam the responsibility of naming the animals. He's given dominion over, you know, he has this role this way. So let's talk about how the woman is supposed to be a helper suitable. And first of all, we see companionship. God saw that man was unable to fulfill the task on his own. Understand this. I think this is so important. He's unable to fulfill the task on his own, and he needed a partner who was complementary to him, someone who would balance his weaknesses and strengthen his strengths. We come to understand this complementarity first by the term used for woman in the second half of the verse, helper suitable. Okay, so God saw that, and he created man, actually, to be incomplete. That is, he needed, in order to have dominion, in order to do what God wanted him to do, he knew that there needed to be, he needed to create a helper suitable for him. In other words, there are things that a man is not wired well to do. And you can ask my wife, and she knows that's true. She will tell me, I don't really know what I'd do without her. I would be a total disaster, actually. So, I see that all the time in our family life, how she compliments me in that way. And I think most of us men can see that. Oh. So here's what it doesn't mean. We're going to start off with what it doesn't mean, because it's safer. What does helper suitable not mean? It does not mean that a wife is a slave to her husband. Proverbs 31 is very clear about that. Nor does it imply that a husband can mistreat his wife in any way. So that's not what we're talking about here. It's not talking about the husband doesn't own the wife. The wife doesn't own the husband. She's not a slave to, so understand that that's not what it's talking about. It does not mean that a wife never has an opinion or never gives advice. In fact, you find a lot of different places where a wife gives very good advice. And like it says in Proverbs 31:26, that the heart of her husband safely trusts in her, that she advises him. And there's this relationship in Proverbs 31 where there is clearly opinions given and advice given. And a husband is really dumb if he doesn't listen to the advice of his wife, and he doesn't listen to the counsel, and he doesn't listen to the cautions. The cautions of his wife. He is not being a very smart man, because he is not understanding that there is just a certain, there are certain things that a man doesn't think about. He's not wired a certain way, and he needs a wife often to compliment him in those things, if God provides that. It does not mean that a wife becomes a wallflower who folds up and allows her abilities to lie dormant. Okay? I just want to be clear about that. So husbands and wives, women are incredibly talented. Men and women are both talented. And it's not as though a wife can, you know, if a wife has talents in various areas or abilities in various areas, this is not saying, well, she should just kind of let all those go dormant. And Proverbs 31, just if you read Proverbs 31, that woman in Proverbs 31, what are some of the things that she's doing? Anybody remember? Yeah, she's buying and selling property. Yeah, she rises up early before her maidens and she feeds them. And her kids and all that. Her husband is known in the gates, so she's helping her husband with his reputation. I mean, you got a lot. She's going, this woman is doing a lot of stuff. Okay? And she's not limited, frankly. Okay? And so it's important to understand that as well. It does not mean that the wife is inferior to her husband. Okay? We've kind of already gone over that, but there's value, equal value. and that kind of thing. She is a partner, a teammate, a co-laborer in the garden. Okay. It doesn't mean, the Bible does not say the woman must be oriented to her husband and not ever work outside the home. Not at all. There is nothing that precludes a woman from working outside the home. Proverbs 31:16. But she must always make her husband, kids, and home her first priority. Okay? Nothing wrong with working outside the home, but it ought to be, she needs to make her husband and her kids the first priority. In other words, the reason she would choose to work outside the home would be because it best helps her husband and kids. Does that make sense? All right. So that's an important thing. So the priority is going to be different for a wife biblically than a woman biblically than a man in a marriage relationship. So what does helper suitable mean? Marriage is not just about specific big decisions, but it's an entire orientation of the wife's life. The wife is engaged in every area of life with the husband, helping him to be faithful to the massive calling on his life. You've got this massive calling that God gives Adam. Frankly, he gives every man a huge calling of stewardship of whatever God has given him. And it is the wife is to be oriented to helping her husband in that way, engaged in every area of life. It's not just, okay, well, you just stay over here. You stay in the kitchen and, you know, do your little duties over here, and I'll go out and do everything else. That is not at all what God had in mind. They are a team working together to accomplish what God and stewarding what God has given them to steward. While the man was oriented to the task of dominion, the terminology suitable helper suggests that she is oriented first to the man, not to the task. That sets up the priority in their relationships. Do you catch that? So the man is oriented to the task of having dominion and of being a steward and of directing the family in the way that it should go. The wife's role is to be oriented to the man in helping. Now that's going to look different in different marriage relationships and different contexts. Okay, but the orientation is going to be that the wife is oriented toward helping her husband fulfill their role together in having dominion over the whatever God has given them, stewardship over whatever God has given them. Does that make sense? Any questions about that one? Yes, Jeff. Stewardship, yeah, stewardship.
Stewardship of the garden.
Well, that's what God had given him at the point. So we see chapter 1, have dominion over, subdue all things, have dominion over the earth, and so that's given to mankind. Adam particularly, okay, his job is in the garden and to make it grow and flourish.
But do you run the risk of focusing too much on the task and not focusing on...
Yes, you could. We'll get to that, but yes, certainly. This is not what we're going to say later, which is that a man is not, it is not as though the man does not help and love his wife. It's servant leadership. Is that what you're getting at? No.
But also just, you can be trying to help the wife by focusing on making sure you do the task, the job outside the home, and not do enough at home to play.
Yeah.
Balance.
Yeah, I think you got a team. And it is going to look a little different depending on the marriage and talents and gifts and things like that. I mean, there are certain things. You know, for example, my wife handles the finances. Okay. Now, I know what's going on all the time, and we talk all the time, and if there's, but she, as far as who writes the checks, which doesn't happen that much anymore, and who pays the bills and those kinds of things, and she handles it because she's good at it. Okay. And I'm super, we're both working together, we make the decisions together, but sometimes in the marriage relationship, the husband ought to be doing that, especially if, like, he's a CPA. Maybe he should be doing that, right? Okay, so it all depends on what the, so the different roles are going to determine what that looks like in different marriages, but this is really just talking about generally the orientation. Does that make sense? It's good to flesh that out. Any other questions or comments about this part? Anybody, any women feeling like, oh, that makes me look inferior? I think I've said it enough that you're not, right? Okay? The orientation is what we're looking at here. Okay, so let's look at then some implications. Brother. I love technology when it works. Okay. So let's go on. Four implications from what we see from Genesis. Number one, in Genesis 2, we see the first indicators of God's desire to give men the authority to lead in the marriage. We see the task given is to a man that and the prohibitions are explained to the man before the woman was ever on the scene. So it's showing us that. Obviously, we have that verified in the New Testament where it says that the head of the woman is the man. Okay, just as the Father is the head of Christ. So there's Sonia. Yeah.
Is that in your mind?
I would struggle with that. Yeah. I don't have a problem with women working. I think that there's sometimes, like, okay, so let's suppose that it can't be helped. Like the woman has more earning power than the man or something for some reason. I don't think that's, I mean, that's okay. That happens sometimes. But I think that the orientation is the key. Like the woman... His primary orientation needs to be provider, and the woman's primary orientation is toward the husband. I think sometimes I think you could have that with the woman earning more. It's a little hard, but I think that you probably could have that. It would just the orientation. You'd have to really be careful about the orientation in a situation like that. Yeah. Yeah. I essentially agree. But usually the person who makes more is usually working longer and things like that. Not always, though. So you just have to be careful, I guess, I put it that way. All right. And by the way, I'll say this. And I'm going out on a limb here a little bit, so don't... It's my birthday tomorrow, so don't hurt me. In a situation where you have a husband and a wife and you have two careers, okay, and maybe both are excelling, but a sacrifice has to be made in order for the other one to excel. Which one has to sacrifice for the other to excel? What do you think? Yeah, the wife needs to sacrifice in order for the husband to excel. Okay. Because the orientation needs to be toward the husband. Okay, if it needs to be, maybe that's not the case. I'm just saying that I've just seen situations where that does happen, and the orientation really needs to be that way. Okay. Implication number two: although the husband is called to lead, that should not preclude him from serving his wife. This is really important. Okay. Yes, we talked about leadership. We talked about him having stewardship responsibility and all that. But we see that Christ gave his entire life for his bride, the church, and the husband is called to model Christ in that way. And so the kind of leadership we're talking about here is servant leadership. We as men ought to be serving our families. In fact, when we go to work, we ought to be doing two things. As we learn Sunday, what should we be doing? Well, we should be working to glorify God. Okay, we should be working to as unto the Lord and unto men. And then the other reason we work is to serve our families. I mean, so it should be a servant kind of leadership that we are providing for our families. Not you serve me and I just bring home the bacon kind of a thing. Okay? That's not the model that we see in Scripture. Implication number three: the marital relationship has a structure to it, not hierarchy. Okay? There's a structure, not a hierarchy. All right. The husband and wife have complementary roles in which authority is exercised and help is both needed and freely given. Okay, so there's authority, but there's you're a team. You're working together. You're it's not a hierarchy, depending on how you define those terms, actually. But this is not a 5-star general standing one level higher than a 4-star general, but a husband holding his wife's hands and leading her forward. You might think that the label helpmate is a demeaning statement to the woman, and yet it says as much about the husband's need to be helped as the wife's extraordinary giftedness to provide that help. Yes?
Yeah, that lesson I was going to kind of point out, it seems like the progressive creation of man and woman served to effectively highlight man's need.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, no woman should feel less because she was the second one created. I mean, there was a need there, and it's not good that man should be alone. All right, and so it does highlight that for sure. And there are, I mean, and you know, I'll just go one step further and say this: women who don't understand that there is a unique God-given role, and they're trying to take a man's role and not see the distinctions, they're not going to experience the value that they really have. And so it's important to understand how this works. Implication number 4: the husband's leading and the wife's helping is the shape of the marriage relationship, not just one aspect of it. So it's to shape the marriage. If you as a husband are called to lead your wife, and you as a wife are oriented toward your husband, then the structure and orientation is going to affect every aspect of your married life. It's not just going to affect important decisions, but it will pervade all areas of your life: finances, parenting, sexuality, communication, all areas. Now, there's some things that will look different depending on the marriage, but understand that this general orientation is going to affect everything. For example, if a wife is handling the finances, but she can't submit to her husband's leadership, like they're working together and it's not working because she thinks that she just has to handle it and he's got to be subservient, then that is going to be a problem. The husband still has to lead in the finances, even if the wife is handling the finances. The truth of the matter is, if you're working together as a team, this is personal experience. If you're working together as a team, I'll be honest with you, there's not that much at least my experience has been, there's not all that much conflict. Usually, Elizabeth and I agree on things. It's very infrequently I'm saying, okay, we're just taking this route. You know, you're handling the finances, you're doing all the bills, you know everything, but you're just taking this route. We're just going to take this route. Okay, yeah.
I think a lot of that goes back to that triangle you showed at the beginning where...
Good. I really think that is so key. The priority. If you have the same priorities, if you both want to please God, if you're both using the same Bible and reading the same Bible and what it says, and you're interpreting the same Bible the same way, and you're applying it scripturally together as a marriage, and you have those priorities, it becomes kind of like a pretty shallow pitch on a roof. Does that make sense? So, like, you have some roofs, and they're like this, all right? So you've got man's at the top, and, you know, there's this sharp pitch. But when everybody has the same, when the husband and the wife have the same priorities, you're going to have a pitch to it. Somebody's got to lead. Somebody's got to call the shot when there is a disagreement, or somebody's got to lead. And there's no question biblically that the husband is to lead. But it's going to be a much shallower pitch because we have the same priorities. We're going the same direction. That's a very, very good point, and it's really key. So those are implications. Okay, I think we actually have a few. Any comments or questions about those? We're going to move after this to the whole leaving and cleaving idea. Any comments or questions about this aspect of it, though?
Well, there really is a hierarchy. The husband's in charge of the wife, and God's in charge of the whole family. So doesn't that say hierarchy?
I think the thing I don't like about the term hierarchy is it sounds like it attributes value based upon rank. Maybe it does. If you don't, if you take that out of it, then you don't. Then fine, you can use that word. But if you think of hierarchy in terms of, okay, a higher rank means higher value, then that's when you run into a problem, because it's not. It's a there's equal value. You have it's structured where one is over the other. But it's
hierarchies are structured too.
Well, yeah, I'm just saying it's structure without the value issue of having different values. Usually, when you think of a 5-star general, 4-star, you sort of have in your mind, well, the one's more valuable than the other. And I mean, it's arguably not true, but that's usually what you think of. So that's the distinction I would make. Any other comments or questions about this part? Everything crystal clear? Wow, this is great. Okay. Let's then go to, are you just being nice to me because my birthday tomorrow? All right. Let's then go to implications of leaving and cleaving. Number one, I wasn't even going to say anything about my birthday, but somebody brought some donuts in, so you already know. Anyway, number one, let's look at the passage that talks about leaving and cleaving before we go into these implications, and we will finish up here pretty soon. But let's see here. Hang on one second, I need to find the right spot. Okay, look at chapter 2, verse 24. It says, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." So let's talk about this whole idea of leaving and cleaving. The word leave basically means that it's to let the other one, it means exactly what it says. It means to leave. You're constructing a new family. You've got husband and wife. They've got a kid. They get married. As soon as they get married, it is a new family unit. Okay, it is a separate family unit. And this is important to understand in the marriage. So the priority for when a husband marries someone, what does that mean? That means that the priority for the husband or the wife, either one, is going to be first to who? Lord first, and then who else? Their spouse. It's not going to be their parents anymore. Okay? This parents come third, or fourth once you have kids, probably. Okay? But you've got to understand that the priority is to the spouse now. It's not to the family. Yes?
How do you integrate this with the concept of the value of singleness? Because here the incentive or the impetus for moving on is getting married.
Yeah. Yeah, some of that is, we kind of discussed that back when we talked about singleness in the beginning. It's much less clear, okay? So there doesn't seem to biblically have to be a clear break like that. It seems to me that it tends to be more gradual. So and often has to do with what the dependency is. What's the financial dependency, emotional dependency, those kinds of things. There isn't a clear break biblically until marriage happens. But let's say a single person they graduate from high school, they go to college. There's some separation that happens a little there. Now, in my opinion, they're still under the parents' authority when they're at college because they're still kids. But anyway. But just walk on a college campus. I know I'm old because I walk on a college campus. And it's like these are kids. Sorry, kid. Sorry, guys. Anyway, okay. Anyway, but that's just true. You're gonna see a little separation there. Okay. Then you're gonna see a little bit more separation. When they get out of college and they get working and they have their own job and they're not financially dependent, you're going to see separation there. If they're moving, if they're not even in the same location, if they're a different, totally different location, you know, one's in California and one's in Maryland, I mean, you're going to have separation there. So I think it tends to be more of a gradual thing more than a clear, defined thing. But once the marriage happens, then we have clearly, it's clearly defined. I don't know if that completely answers the question. Yeah.
a certain age was not going to make it to the promised land, the ones younger than that were, so there was a separation of responsibility or...
Yeah, I'd have a hard time making the connection, to be honest with you, between that and having to do with adulthood. I mean, we have even Galatians says that, and I think it's chapter 3 that says that we're under tutors and governors until the time appointed by the Father. That's a little clearer, but even that's not actually, the context really isn't even talking about that. I don't know if I'd make that connection, honestly, Tim. I'd have to look at it a little closer, though. What was the age? I don't remember what the age was for that.
20.
20? Okay. Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting concept. I'd have to look at it more. I'll have to give that some thought. But, okay, I think we probably... Any other questions? We're not going to get into the implications yet, but we'll get into that next week. I don't think we have time to finish it. Any other questions about anything we've talked about? Oh, okay. Very good. Let's go ahead then, and let me take a few prayer requests, and then, teens, you're dismissed. I'll be down there in just a few minutes, Julie. But I wanted to cover a couple of things as far as prayer requests are concerned.